Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hey, it's John here. The podcast hasn't technically started yet. It'll be along in a minute, I promise. But before we get going, I just wanted to basically ask you all for a favour. You're all very nice people. You've all been listening to us enthusiastically, I hope. So now I want something in return. I'm not going to ask for money, don't worry. What I would like, though, is if you had 5 minutes to give us a nice review on iTunes and to tell your friends, because we'd like to get more people listening to this and we think you're the best people to help us do that. So go on, be nice, do us a favour. Anyway, that's the public service announcement over. I now return you to your normal podcast service.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm Barbara.
And I'm John. And this week we're talking about, you know, I don't actually really know what we're talking about. The plan to make this episode coherent has kind of collapsed, like the British government in the last couple of weeks. So, you know, but it's going to be good. It's interesting. Just bear with me on this. So last time, as regular listeners will recall, in our last episode, we were a little bit worried about the possibilities that the UK was about to vote to leave the European Union. The good news on that is that we weren't being paranoid. and things are now looking a little bit horrific all round and probably going to get worse. I mean, how are you feeling about it, Barbara?
I feel like I've not yet hit the real despondency yet, because there's been story after story after story and kind of work on the weekend and random Labour resignations. But I'm sure I'm about to hit that at some point. But until then, I've just been reading news stories instead of sitting feeling depressed.
Yeah, I'm finding it a bit like a bereavement. I keep kind of feeling like I've got my head around it, and then some other aspect of it hits me, the full horror, and I have to sit down and start all over again. To kind of help us through our hour of need here, we're joined by our colleague Stephanie Boland, with whom we're going to talk about identity and cities, and why it is that, by and large, it was Britain's cities were more likely to vote to remain than the countryside. Stephanie, you wrote a very interesting piece about your sense of identity being tied up with having sort of travelled around Europe and had to sort of translate your work into a few different languages.
Yes, well, for me it was kind of born out of going, there is, I think, increasingly for people specifically of my generation, a feeling that we know people from all over the world, we travel all over the world. And what's been interesting to me in the fallout of the Brexit vote has been seeing people have a real visceral emotional reaction to the idea that we are not part of Europe. And I think it surprised a lot of people I know who have gone, I didn't realise I felt so European until our country went and we're not. I don't know if that's the case with you, Barbara.
Yeah, I think it's similar. I think also that when we're talking about these cities and why mysteriously this was the kind of the division, I think that people in cities do identify more with this sense of going places, of seeking things out and moving around. Obviously that bears out in actual demographic data about, you know, most people in cities aren't necessarily born there, whereas in rural areas you're probably slightly more likely to be kind of born and bred from the same place. But yeah, I think that kind of identity of being able to move, being able to strive, being able to go to a different place is something that I think a lot of people really identify with. And it's kind of a surprise because there was this idea that there was a British identity that was being called out to by the Leave campaigners. But it kind of is very sad that it turns out there was an equivalent one, which I don't think Remain really managed to invoke very successfully, which is why we're in this position now, I personally think.
Because you did a great post on the actual demographic breakdown, and there is a really stark divide, isn't there, between rural and urban?
Yeah, so there's a rural and urban divide. I mean, an interesting aspect people aren't talking about too much is turnout, because the problem is basically that Remainers were in cities, Remainers didn't come and vote. The turnout figures for places like Manchester are very low, kind of in the 50s as opposed to in the 70s, which is the overall average. So that's kind of why I do feel like people did feel strongly that they wanted to remain, but there wasn't enough of that kind of groundswell of feeling about it that got people out of their houses and down to polling stations.
But it's a difficult thing, and I found it a difficult thing particularly, and I know this is something we've spoken about in the office in the week subsequent to the result coming out, there's been a lot of talking about people in the countryside and talking about leavers as being kind of stupid and self-defeating and suicidal. And this idea that you're naive as opposed to the liberal intelligentsia who live in cities and know what's good for our country.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not. I mean, the downside of all this kind of emotion on both sides is that emotion doesn't necessarily come with a big pamphlet full of facts. And both sides tried that tactic probably more than they tried to inform people. So I don't buy this idea that certain people are stupid and Remainers are really clever. I think both sides actually did not have a grasp of the facts. And really, looking back, I'd actually rather we'd had a low turnout, boring referendum about a boring administrative body, which people who wouldn't have kind of falsely engaged people on false promises, either with this vision of a united Europe or with this vision of kind of tea cake town Britain alone by itself and having a brilliant time. In a way, this huge engagement, this huge turnout is sort of part of, I don't want to say the problem because I think it's great that people voted, but it's very surprising that many people did.
It's a reflection that this was a visceral rather than a considered decision.
Yeah, and on both sides.
I think it's worth noting that one of the biggest predictors of the likelihood to someone vote Remain was whether they had a degree. Now, I don't think that means that clever people all think Britain should be in the European Union, but it's more that I think if you've been to university, you're more likely to have that kind of metropolitan, outward-looking outlook, rather than sort of defining yourself purely in terms of some older conception of nation-statehood, I think.
But there was also a huge, I mean, this is a problem that it's unclear the causation here, because actually another of the biggest predictors was income, another was house ownership, another was having a passport. So those factors are all combined, all kind of interrelated. So it may be that you're more privileged because you've had a degree, and therefore other factors have made you less kind of protective of the job market, less kind of suspicious of the economy within a European body.
I think that idea of the job market is so interesting, because there's this, I think this idea that if you're in a northern town and you're worried about immigration, you're either racist or an idiot and don't realise what it will do for you economically. But increasingly you look at rural areas and go, no, you, it's not an illogical thing to be worried about a load of working age people suddenly flooding a limited working economy, which isn't really a problem we have so much in cities. And it's interesting to me that Sheffield was kind of the exception to the city voting.
And if you turn that idea on its head, I mean, frankly, if we're talking about people who see the benefits of free movement, have experienced the exciting nature of kind of Europe and of globalization, what you're really saying is there are people there who haven't had those opportunities, and aid maybe as a result don't see the benefits, but also the fact that they don't get that and other people do. I can see why that would make you quite angry.
We are meant to be talking about cities, so let's kind of actually look at let's bombard you with numbers, because people love them. I just did a post making some charts, so I don't see why you guys shouldn't suffer. To the top of the league table for the most pro-European city in Britain, does anyone know what it was off the top of their heads?
London?
Nope.
Was it Edinburgh?
It was Edinburgh. Well done. Scotland was obviously, Scotland voted Remain, even if the UK didn't, so that's going to be fun. But all the Scottish cities were quite strong Remain votes, including Dundee, which is, you know, in terms of its economic profile, is much closer to places like Harlow, Middlesbrough.
But it is a port town, its economic its industries are international.
Yeah, but that's probably true of places like Hull as well. But Hull was at the very, I'm giving away the ending here, but Hull was at the very other end of the league table, where barely 30% of people voted to remain. Other cities near the top of the Remain league tables, you've got Oxford and Cambridge, both of which are obviously small university towns, will be very international, very educated. London, actually financial services is probably a big predictor here, because both London and Edinburgh are very dependent on the financial services industry, which is quite international. But then you've got places like Brighton, which is sort of London on sea, Glasgow, Bristol, da-da-da. The weird ones, sort of, the ones that confuse me are, you already mentioned Sheffield, but also like Leeds and Birmingham and Nottingham, all of which are quite big cities, are still all sort of hovering around the 50% mark. They're kind of in line with the national average, whereas most cities seem to be above that. So it's kind of like Birmingham, I think, is the only city of like a million people or more in Britain that went for leave.
Not to become the ersatz Stephen Bush of this episode of this podcast, but is that to do with the boundaries? Because I know Sheffield incorporates a lot of commuter belt in its boundary, whereas somewhere like Manchester doesn't. So Oldham voted very strongly for leave, but Oldham is not incorporated in Manchester. Is that also the case with Birmingham, perhaps?
That's probably a factor. I mean, like the boundary of Birmingham includes like a lot of northern and southern suburbs, but not eastern and western ones, because they all fall under different administrations. So yeah, it's you can probably explain a lot on boundaries, to be honest, but nonetheless, it's... Yeah.
So Hull is not other people, as it happens.
I mean, I think that's just going to kill the whole conversation. Maybe that's probably a sign we should move on.
Sorry. Can we talk about Belfast? Because I was in Belfast a couple of weeks ago and I was really struck by the divide between Leave and Remain voters and the sense of feeling there. And I've just heard today that there's, post offices running out of Irish passport applications because people are worried about losing their EU passport. I'm guessing it's a similar kind of thing in Glasgow and Edinburgh. You've got people gambling if we do another Indy Ref. What is happening with cities in the Celtic Fringe?
That is really interesting, though, isn't it? That people are like more concerned about their European identity is more important to them than their British one.
And really. It's in parts of Belfast where British identity is a bit of a big deal as well. You know, it's a really kind of surprising... In loyalist parts of East Belfast are running out of Irish passport applications.
Well, one of the many weird things to have happened, there's been so many of these that people just keep forgetting. That happened with the Spanish once Gibraltar back, don't they? I've forgotten about that. one of the many weird things we've just kind of skated over is that Ian Paisley Jr., who's obviously the son of the great unionist politician... great in inverted commas, was suggesting that his constituents go and apply for Irish passports, which is just absolutely crazy.
So what interested me, though, was that kind of Wales had no part in this kind of regional backlash against what maybe people are now thinking of as these English, slightly unwelcome values. So, I mean, where did Cardiff come in your big chart, John?
I've got it at 60%. Pro Remain, which is quite, I mean, that's, it's sort of in the top third.
But considering places like London were mostly kind of 70-75%, I guess that is slightly following the Welsh trend of basically wanting out.
Maybe. I mean, I think Cardiff is also, it's obviously a big sort of creative city. There's a lot of TV made there.
And students.
Yeah. So I think between those two things. But you're right, like Wales as a whole was surprisingly pro-leave, which is weird because Europe has given Wales a lot of money.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So there's gratitude for you. So we've been talking about how cities are often different from the countries that contain them. Some people think that's probably not only a good thing, but that cities actually sort of represent the future of not just of their particular nations, but of the world. In 2013, the US political theorist Benjamin Barber published a book called If Mayors Ruled the World. A couple of weeks ago, he was in London to speak at an event organised by our old mates at the Centre for Cities. And we were lucky enough to grab a few minutes of his time to talk to him for this podcast. I'm going to own up front here that the sound quality on this thing is dreadful because I recorded it on my phone and I'm not the most technically minded person. But I am assured after significant editing, it is at the very least audible. And Ben Barber's a big enough person that I thought it was worth persevering with. So, here's how cities can save the world.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
Yes, and let me say, I'm not an urbanist or a cities guy. I'm a democratic theorist and practitioner. I've always thought the nation-state and international organizations based on it are the place to look for thinking about governance and thinking about democracy. But what changed my mind wasn't so much the good that cities are doing, although there's a lot of good they're doing, but the increasing seeming dysfunction of nation states. And I don't just mean the dysfunction as you find in Venezuela or Brazil or Yemen. I mean a more fundamental dysfunction. Nation states were created 400 years ago as the principal instrument of government in a new Europe and eventually around the world, where the scale of cities was inadequate to the new scale of national peoples and of territories. And the nation state and the social contract said that basically citizenship and the obedience to government was a function of a sovereign state with independence, with borders and frontiers, and with the sovereign capacity to take care of the major issues, education, economic, war and peace, disease, health, you name it, that most citizens cared about. And for 400 years, the nation state has basically worked within the jurisdiction of states to deal with the primary problems that citizens have. What's changed in the late 20th century and into the 21st century is that a world of bordered states, of independence, of sovereign jurisdictions, no longer is consistent with the actual interdependent, borderless, globalized world we live in. We live in a world without borders with respect to disease, with respect to terrorism and insecurity, with respect to climate change. We have a worldwide web, not a Leicester web or a New York web. We see the migration of peoples around the world, refugees, people fleeing genocide and war, people looking for jobs. 60 million people on Earth are now displaced and moving across borders. In other words, we live in a borderless world whose primary primary challenges are interdependent, and we're still trying to respond to those problems with 17th century bordered sovereign nation states. And so quite aside from the current dysfunctions of specific governments, we live in a world where that dysfunction is institutional and historic, not just about the particular problems of the time, which means that there's another casualty. So it's not just good governance that's a casualty, it's democracy, because democracy was wrapped up at its birth in the social contract in the sovereign nation state. National states were democratic states primarily in Europe. The revolutions took place in national states like France and America. Democracy has, in effect, placed its destiny in the hands of the nation state. So I began thinking, well, wait a minute, is this hopeless? The nation state's done. International organizations don't work because they're based on nation states. It's not the United Nations, it's the disunited nations. International organizations don't work either. What's the alternative? And I began thinking more and more about cities, which are much older, are more primeval in the sense they are the Ur communities, they are the Urgemeinden, the Germans would say they are the original human communities. They represent a more accessible level of government for citizens. Turns out when you do polls that people trust municipal government about twice the level they trust their national governments. About 35% of people on average trust their national governments. About 70% of people on average trust their mayors and municipalities. So on every level, and they're also more participatory. They're more democratic. Citizens are involved. So I began looking at cities and trying to figure out why do cities work so well. What I found is that mayors as individuals are more localized and rooted in their communities. They're far more pragmatic, and therefore they're less interested in 19th century ideologies. They understand technology and the new technological and knowledge markets, because that's how new cities have to make their living in a post-industrial world. And most importantly, they understand diversity and multiculturalism, because from all the way back, cities have been multicultural, centers of trade, centers of tourism. Cities have always been far more diverse and multicultural than the states they belong to. England is English. London and Leicester are not English. Mexico is Mexican, but Mexico City has a wide diversity of people. This is true all over the world. Cities are far more diverse and multicultural than the monocultural states to which they belong, and this makes them much more like the new world we live in, much more able to respond to and deal with migration, with refugees, with issues even of security and terrorism associated sometimes with refugees, because this is where the refugees are. There are 12 million people who cross the borders without the permission of the national government. They are illegal. But in terms of the logic of the global economy, the logic of jobs, the logic of families, they're perfectly legal. Now, the national government, even including the progressive Obama, is busy deporting them. But mayors say they're here. Their families are here. They drive cars. Let's give them a license. They go to school. Let's let the kids get identity papers so they can go to school. Right now, they're using emergency rooms, a very expensive way to do medical care. Let's get some papers. So they, in other words, cities are saying, we will give them local visas, even though they don't have national visas, because that's the reality. Mayors are realists. Mayors are pragmatists. Mayors deal with the realities. And that makes the city much more functional and operational than national government.
I mean, it is very clear that Boris Johnson, for one, was very pro-immigration when he was a mayor, and exactly. Somehow flipped. Yeah, now he's gone back to be a national politician. But why do you think cities are kind of better at problem solving?
If we think of the origins of government, we didn't originate government to decide whether we should have a market economy or a state economy. Governments were instituted among men to do things like educate young people, provide medical care, provide social security, to run the economy. In other words, local government was founded to do very practical, real things. And in cities, that's still what they're there for. And mayors get that. You know, Washington, D.C. closed twice in the last 2 years. Twice. For 2 weeks at a time. Nobody even noticed. You imagine closing London, closing New York? You can't close cities. That's where people live. That's where they operate. And that's why mayors don't have the luxury of having ideological quarrels. They've got to, I mean, sure, they can argue about should we have the garbage picked up by private firms or public firms, but in the end, they've got to admit, they can't say, well, we can't decide that, so we just won't pick up the garbage for 6 months. So the reality is mayors are dealing with the real issues of governance for which governments were instituted among men and women, and they have to do that job, whereas at higher levels of jurisdiction, you have these abstract ideological and party debates and this paralysis, because at that level, the real functions of government disappear and are occluded by these large, big, interesting, and curious intellectual and ideological debates.
You're not just a theorist, though. You are setting up the Global Parliament and NEST.
I was never just a theorist. I worked in the Clinton. I worked for Bill Clinton as an advisor. I worked for a number of presidential candidates in the United States, and I've been an advisor to governors and also to others around the world. So I've always felt that the role of a theorist is also just guide and at least advise and give whatever advice they can. The elected guy is the one who has the real power and the real responsibility, and you can't pretend to be that, but you can certainly try. So I've always been plugged in, but that comes to one question I didn't answer, because you said, well, fine, let's go back to cities. But wait a minute, you said we need to govern the world. How can cities, which is going back to the local level, govern the world? Well, it turns out the major problems of the urban landscape, climate change, migration, transportation, are global problems. Local and global problems are the same. The ones left out are the national governments, where they're dealing with neither the local nor the global. So cities have a great sense of the global world we live in. But in order to address those questions, they can't do it one by one. They have to do it together. And there are already a great number of networks out there, ICLE, the C40 Climate Cities, UCLG, EuroCities, and every nation has its National Association of Cities, its Municipal League. But what's lacking is a genuinely political organization of mayors, one that puts muscle on the bones of city organization, one that gives cities a global voice, a platform for common action. And the Global Panel of Mayors, which will convene in its inaugural sitting in The Hague, City of Peace and Justice, where the League of Nations was born and all the courts are, 10th to 12th of September, this fall, the Global Parliament of Mayors will meet for the first time with anywhere from 75 to 100 African mayors. They will meet for the first time and take up three issues in this first sitting. They will take up climate, what cities can do on that. 80% of global emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, come from cities. They will take up refugees. That's where all the people, the refugees are in cities. They're not in farms. And the issue of governance itself, some of the issues we talked about here today. What is the right of cities to govern? What is the responsibility of cities and mayors to govern? Those will be the three issues. Let's put them in a room together. Let's let them meet on a regular basis. Let's give them a digital platform and see how well they do. My prediction is, although that's a pretty low bar, they will do a lot better than nation states.
I mean, it kind of strikes me that, I mean, the book is called If Mayors Ruled the World, but what we're really talking about here is saving the world in some ways. It's kind of that level of ambition.
Well, you're right, and that would have been a little too maybe dramatic, but you're quite right. It is, I mean, not just saving the world, but saving democracy. It's about saving the world in terms of climate change and terrorism and security, but it's also about saving democracy, making citizens believe once again that their votes matter, that their engagement civically matters, that we can collectively deal with our problems and don't have to look cynically at government as part of the problem, but as it should be, part of the solution, because government is us, and our government is finding ways to cooperate with other city governments around the world to solve our common problems.
So the first meeting of the new Global Parliament of Mayors is happening in September, and Barbara is a real evangelist for this stuff. At the same meeting where I called him to make that tape, one of the other attendees was Peter Salisbury, the Mayor of Leicester, and it took me quite a long time to corner Barbara and get a lot of time I had with him, because he was so intent on convincing Salisbury to come to this meeting, and this is why Leicester comes up so much on that tape, if you're wondering. Barbara, you first wrote about this Global Parliament idea in 2014. You know, what do you make of this whole plan?
I think it's really impressive. I mean, Ben Barber, as he kind of alludes to, wrote a book called If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities, which a lot of people do stuff like that. It's kind of abstract, exciting ideas type nonfiction. But I do think that the fact they've turned it into a real and concrete plan is incredibly impressive, and is almost a proof of concept in itself that these people are willing to do this. because I mean, it's hard to kind of define what it is, because actually their focus is more on kind of sharing ideas. We think of a parliament as a body that makes laws. That wouldn't be what these guys would be doing, and they can kind of come and go as they please. It's not a body that you kind of sign up to and then make loads of decisions within. But I think the idea is basically that they can help each other far more than, you know, a random country can help its own city in a way, because they have such similar problems, such similar concerns. I mean, I know this week, Sadiq Khan and I think Anne Hidalgo co-wrote a letter.
Mayor of Paris.
Yeah. Just about how those two cities can work together. So I think this is a real rising idea, actually. And actually, if anything, the recent referendum kind of shows that cities have a lot in common, especially in the way that their residents think.
Yeah, Khan actually released a statement the morning after the referendum, which said explicitly to the, you know, to the million European citizens who live in London, you know, you are still welcome here. And I think that's, you can't imagine the national prime minister doing that in quite the same way. That is kind of very much a sort of a city response to kind of take that overtly internationalist pro-immigration response.
Yeah. And it's not just kind of, it all sounds very kind of positivist, or they can share great ideas, but also cities share a lot of the same big problems as well. So say pollution is something that cities generally, I mean, it depends on the kind of climate where you are and the way that the winds take the pollution away, but cities tend to suffer from it in a way that rural areas don't. So, for example, a really great strategy for dealing with pollution would be as useful to someone in Beijing as it might be to Sadiq Khan in London.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the ways in which you can see that cities do share ideas and, you know, frankly, steal ideas from each other is the way cycle hire schemes have really spread around the world in the last couple of years. Whereas that seemed, you know, even sort of 5 years ago, that seemed quite a radical idea almost. Now it's sort of pretty rare to go to a major Western city where there isn't some form of bike sharing scheme up there.
Yeah, and presumably, I don't have the sources for this, but when people set those schemes up, they're not looking to, oh, how does our country do transport? They're looking to, how do international cities run these schemes? So in a way, I suppose the sharing that Ben Barber's talking about is kind of already happening, but to have a specific forum. And again, there's this focus on a kind of digital platform and a sharing of ideas digitally, which kind of would make it less focused on just having to meet up once a year and more on this kind of constant exchange of ideas.
The other thing I find really interesting about his ideas is that the failure of the nation state. I mean, he's got a nice line, slightly aggressive almost, but I mean, it's a very nice line nonetheless, that, you know, when Germany wanted to expand its land area, you know, Belgium and Poland felt that in quite a bad way. But Berlin, Brussels and Warsaw can all be great cities at the same time and sort of learn from each other. I think there is just this sort of psychological difference around the nation state where they do feel competitive because boundaries are a zero-sum game. Whereas London and Paris can both thrive and actually benefit from being quite closely networked mega cities that are a couple of hours away from each other and sharing great ideas.
And yeah, I suppose cities don't need to have that sense of competitiveness in that they do just have to be very practical. I mean, there was a mayor of New York called Fiorella LaGuardia, apologies if I pronounce that
wrong.
He's
now got his own airport.
Yeah, good for him. Who said there is no democratic or Republican way of fixing a sewer, which is basically right. I mean, when it comes down to it, the sewer needs to be fixed. You're not going to be kind of, you're looking only for the best way to do that, really, aren't you?
Yeah, I do love the way that this idea that national governments can shut down for extended periods. And halfway through that sentence, I realised that is exactly what's happening in the UK right now. We effectively don't have a government. So
that's fine.
That's great. It's going absolutely swimmingly. But yeah, you know, if you didn't have someone emptying the bins every day, you do notice. In fact, the one time I went to a city where the bin men were on strike for an extended period was when I went to Naples in, I think, 2009. And you could tell as soon as you got there that something had gone horribly wrong, because it was literally in the air. Whereas, you know, when the federal government in Washington, D.C. shuts down, it's a while before. I mean, it does eventually sort of kick in, the problems from that. Like, I think some of the problems that Belgium has around its security services at the moment have been attributed to the fact that there was just nobody coordinating security policy for a very long time. But that really took a couple of years to show its head, whereas something like the bins or the sewers or whatever, you do spot pretty much instantly. Do you buy this idea that we can actually solve problems like climate change in cities, though? I mean, is this enough? Or is this just the latest way in which we're deluding ourselves?
I think my instinct is probably that this will overridingly help cities themselves, at least at first, because, I mean, again, you kind of care the most just about the things that directly affect people where you live. So you might fix the pollution problem on Oxford Street. You're not going to fix climate change in the world, let alone in the UK. So I don't know, but I think the indirect effect might be very good, because in general, like, things that help very concentrated bodies of people tend to help the world as well.
I suppose also there's an argument that just the sheer number of people that live in cities, I mean, it's obviously, as ever, it depends how you count, but, you know, on some measures, more than half the world's population is now urban. If you can cut the carbon footprint of each of those people by a third, that is a major impact on climate change.
Yeah, and I mean, urbanism in a way is kind of an exercise of efficiency, and this project is basically a way of making cities more efficient, because if you fix something more easily using someone else's plan, you save money. If you cut pollution, you're helping slow climate change. You're kind of preserving your resources. So if we can preserve resources within those areas where, as you say, half of people live, then maybe you can save the world. We'll see.
I think it's also worth noting that it's not just a sort of jolly for all the mayors, because if it was, they probably wouldn't be going to The Hague. It's not known as a
party capital,
yeah.
Secretly, just a mayoral stag do.
they're not all going to be hanging around by the pool next to the Court of Justice or something. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Barbara Speed and produced by Royfield Brown. Our theme music is Dust from the Stars by Charlie Charles. You also heard The Weather by Destinazione Altrove and Embryonic Waves, composed by Matthew Reitzel. All music in the show is licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast and on iTunes, where you'll also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. You can also talk to us on Twitter and on Facebook, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. And if you wanted to leave a review to tell your friends how lovely we are, well, we'd very much appreciate that. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하 서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.